Okay, so we're gonna do a Q&A. What I'll do is I'll take five people from each side, and because we have the microphones here, I'll make you line up here. So I'll call and give you each a number, and that'll be your number on the line. Okay?
And everybody has 2 minutes?
1 minute.
Oh, 1 minute?
Yeah, we have a large crowd. We want to hear everybody. So everybody will have 1 minute. And also, so he will let you know when you've reached the 30 seconds, the 15, and when your time is up. And if you have a question, keep your question to one at a time. And after you're lined up here, Dr. Mate will address your questions one at a time. Okay, so let's get started. So 1, 2, 3, 4, okay, 5, 6, 7. So go ahead. If you can come up here and line up. So I see two over there, 8, 9, and
hi, Dr. Mate. Thank you very much Gabor. For talking. Gabor. My name's Julia. I'm starting out as a journalist, writing a lot about addiction in this country. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the disease concept and how all this new research about what goes on in the brain after, you know, not only exposure in rats and in animals, but now what they know about the human brain and how that sort of plays with the stigma so far.
Yeah, sure. So the addiction is a brain disease. Well, surely it's true that if you do brain scans on drug addicts, substance addicts, you're going to see certain changes. You're going to see, for example, underdevelopment with time of the white matter, the connective matter of the brain. You're going to see even shrinking of the gray matter of the brain. You're going to see a diminished number of receptors for dopamine or endorphins, the brain's natural opiates. You're going to see shrinkage of other brain organs. That's a fact, so that the brain in addiction does become a diseased organ. What the disease model does not answer is why do people get addicted in the first place? And what were their brains like before the addiction happened? And that's because the medical profession is traumaphobic. So they don't actually look at the actual causes of what creates the template. And what I'm saying is that it's not even controversial anymore. When I say it's not controversial, it's not scientifically controversial, but completely missing from medical education, that the brain actually develops an interaction with the environment. So kids who don't get those conditions that I talked about as being necessary, or kids particularly who are traumatized, their brains will develop in such ways as to make them prone to use drugs. I won't go into the details of that, but that's the fact. So key brain circuits and receptors and so on will be underdeveloped. And they're the ones then who will be one of using the drugs. And then their brains get diseased. But the point is, their brains never functioned well in the first place because the conditions for the brain development were lacking because of all the trauma and all the stress. So that the disease model of addiction does not take into account the actual intrauterine and postnatal and childhood experience that shape the brain circuits that then become prone to be soothed by drugs later on. In other words, it's true as far as it goes, but it does not deal with the underlying cause of it.
How could a doctor start to address that?
How can a doctor start to address that? Well, just by listening to people. What happened to you? What was your childhood like? You know, how were you treated? How did you feel about yourself? Ask a patient, what does the drug do for you? One sex trade worker said to me that heroin makes, the first time she did heroin, it felt like a warm, soft hug. Now why? Because heroin attaches to the endorphin receptors in the brain, endorphins being our natural opiates. And those natural opiates are involved in the experience of love. What she was telling me is she had no love in her life until she did the heroin. So you got to listen to people. I can't give you a longer talk on how to treat addiction, but you have to begin by recognition of the human experience that underlies the addictive drive.
Thank you so much for being here. My name is Amy. I have a 28-year-old son with schizoaffective disorder. He's in Santa Rita Jail. And I'm here to say that his family and his culture let him down. He's not a criminal. I know what the problem is with the mental health, and everything you said is right on. And I'm several generations of a high-stress parent. Yeah. My question is, you know, I'm orthomolecular, looking to treat the holistic. I know he's got gut dysbiosis, possible viral infections, too many antibiotic use. You know, the whole... He's taught me unconditional love through this. What is the best thing I could do for him right now to support him in this condition, in this situation, as we go along?
Well, gosh, I'd have to know a lot more to be able to answer you in detail. But I mean, the key to what you said is not just in your unconditional love, although that's a major key. And unconditional means that you're going to love him no matter what. But something else, which is that you don't see him only through the lens of his dysfunctions, but that you see in him the possibilities. Because the possibility of recovery is in him. Now, if you only see him through his behavior, circumstances, and appearances, you don't see the real him. And so that means for us parents who've got kids who may have problems, it's very difficult to see the kid as something other than through the lens of our own anxieties. So you need to, maybe you already have, maybe I'm already telling you something you already know, but you need to get past your anxieties and see the real, genuine human possibility in him and mirror that back to him. That's the biggest thing you can do for him. By the way, I just, before I forget, we didn't, neither Todd and I, and I don't know whether he's got ADD or not, but I certainly do, got together to organize bringing my books here for sale, so that they're not here for you to purchase tonight. So those who are interested in more deeply in my ideas, my four books are available online or at any decent bookstore can order in for you. Okay? We have one to sign here? Yeah, okay, yeah, it's okay, I'll sign that one book, but for the rest of you. So all I mean to say is that what you've asked me here is further acknowledged or further developed in my book on addiction. Okay? Thank you.
Hi, yeah, I really appreciate you being here. Every time I have a conversation with somebody about something like this, about how, when it comes to statistics about autism or depression or whatever kind of mental illness, how it's risen in the past decades, almost every time I talk to somebody about that, the reaction is usually something like, well, that's probably just because we've gotten better at recognizing those things. Statistics has gotten more sophisticated and so on. Yeah. I was wondering how much truth there actually is to that, if you could speak to that.
Well, I understand that argument, and intellectually it's a valid argument, but that doesn't make it true. And it was actually in California here there was a study on autism that seemed to refute that it wasn't just a question of more adept diagnosis, it's actually a question of numbers going up. And if you talk to anybody who's been helping I can't prove this, but my sense is very strongly, and anybody who's been in helping professions for a while or in teaching, for example, will tell you they're seeing many more troubled kids than they used to, not just because they're recognizing them, because they're there. And so that kind of argument is one of those ideologically driven, self-justifying perspectives that invite complacency.
Thank you so much. I'm also someone who saw the lie in the American dream through the Vietnam War. And part of that experience was using marijuana and being part of the culture of the time. But I later became addicted to it, and I've had to stop. What worries me about our movement today is that a lot of people, seeing the lie of the war on drugs and seeing that it's not instantly addictive, put a plus where our opponents put a minus, yeah, and think it's a great thing and that everybody can be healthy using marijuana in large amounts for long periods of time. Yeah. And that worries me about our movement, because I think it takes a clear head to build a movement of empowerment and relation and being there for each other and figuring out where the hell we're going to go, disagreeing with each other, because that's positive. But what do you say to the people who are so pro use of drugs that it's can be a problem.
Well, I would ask, see, if people enjoy the drug experience and they can do it every once in a while and let go of it, that might be okay. But if somebody arguing, if somebody's, I'm not part of that conversation, but if there are people who advocate strongly for the use of certain drugs on a regular basis, I would ask them, what does the drug do for you? What does it actually do for you? Well, it makes me feel more alive, whatever it does. Well, then the question is, well, why don't you feel alive in the rest of your life? What's lacking for you? How did you lose it? In other words, I wouldn't make an ideological argument out of it. I'd actually investigate what is it that they're looking for and how is it that they've lost touch with whatever qualities the drug can give them without which they don't feel okay about themselves. That's the conversation I'd be having. I might have the same concern that you have, but I would never debate with anybody. But if they were open to the conversation, I would want to investigate what is it that they're getting that's otherwise missing from their lives. Yeah.
Hi there. My name is Eve, and I'm glad to be here. So thank you for being actually, I think it was meant to be that I'm here. Because I was just passing by. Anyway, yeah, because somebody just invited me. I didn't know anything about this. So my question is, I have 9 years of work experience with in social services, where I mostly work with homeless and substance abusers. And I don't know how many times I've had countless discussion arguments with doctors and psychiatrists telling them that addiction, there's another level, there's a social level in it as well. And I just came back from Australia. Well,
so you're saying that it's on a social level?
Yeah, there's a social level. I'm totally agreeing with you. So I said, I don't know how many times I've had discussion with them. So I just came back from Australia. I was studying international public health. So because I'm transitioning, so it has become even more undeniable, like, you know, the impact of social determinants, you know, in everything, right? So my question to you now, how do we heal from social disease, or basically actually, how does medicine, or when medicine will approach or will address social programming? Because basically I think the problem is that the word that the social programming, how do you think it will be a point where medicine will address that? Because if we don't do that, then, well, because I think that's what exactly what you're talking about. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you. The quick answer is a question. What do you call somebody who tries to fix in somebody else an emotional dysfunction that they haven't resolved in themselves? A psychiatrist, yeah, okay? So that what you got to understand is that a lot of the medical profession is in denial. Yeah, what do you call a person who tries to fix in somebody else emotional dysfunction they haven't resolved in themselves? The answer is you call them a psychiatrist. And that's not a slur, actually, it's just a fact very often, is that because psychiatry is in this model of there's something wrong with you and I'm going to fix it. Not that I'm going to help you heal, but there's something wrong with you and I'm going to fix it, which is denial that there's something wrong with me. And I'm going to try and control in you what I haven't resolved in myself. So there's very much that ethic in medical practice, that we are the experts and we're going to fix it in you. That's the first one. The second point is medical education nowhere tells people that the human brain develops an interaction with the environment. It's pure science ignored in medical practice. Medical education nowhere tells people about the mind-body unity. We separate it. Medical education furthermore stresses people to such a degree that the doctor gets into survival mode. And then in a system where, you know, the rewards are monetary and the more people you see, the more money you make, how are we promoting any kind of a model of humane medicine? And furthermore, the mind-body separation that the medical profession embodies really is endemic in Western thought going back to ancient Greek times. So it's an uphill battle, to say the least. But one thing I can tell you, when I went to medical school, I was taught to deliver babies in such a way as that when the baby appeared in the perineum, at the pelvic outlet, you took the mother into an operating theater, you strapped her to a metal bed, you put her feet into stirrups, You tied her down. And then what you did is when the baby started heading to crown, or the head was starting to push through the opening, then you infiltrated local anesthetic, and then you made a cut called an episiotomy, because nature, you see, doesn't know how to deliver babies without medical intervention. And then I happened to begin to work with some midwives who taught me, you know what, the woman doesn't have to lie down on a bed, she can squat, like people do in Africa. You can actually more efficiently push if she wants to. We don't have to tie them down. We don't have to cut the women necessarily, unless there's a real complication. Now, that was back in the early 70s when I was in medical school. And now, at least, there's a much broader movement. And now there has been medical studies to show that you don't need to make these cuts in women. The reason for whatever changes have occurred, it's not that medical practice has totally changed, but in many places now, women can actually deliver with midwives. They can deliver not having to strap down to a bed. And that came from consumer pressure. That came from women saying, I don't want to do that way anymore. Right. So the medical profession is not going to change from within. That's going to be very slow. There are voices in the medical profession, they're advocating for transformation, but and they're making some encouraging headway, but that's going to take a long period of time, and it'll be immeasurably speeded up if there was genuine consumer pressure. So again, that's a matter of organizing and of bringing pressure to bear from the outside. It's a very conservative and hidebound profession.
Hi. I'm involved with children, elementary age children, who are definitely the result of high stress environments, disenfranchised culture, high stress parents, low income. And I'm only a part-time educator, but it's a constant push and pull of trying to get kids' attention, yeah. 30 at a time.
Yeah.
And I end up just feeling like I'm a police officer, unwanted, role of being a police officer. And I'm just wondering if, of your understanding of ADD, ADHD, if you have any guidelines to create a more loving, supportive environment for kids.
Well, my guess is that you're already doing your best with that. The problem, of course, is that what you really need is not to have 30 kids in the classroom, but to have 15. Now, for that, you'd have to have somebody in power who says, you know what? We're spending too much money on jails and not enough on education. That's not a huge intellectual leap, but it's way beyond what many decision makers are capable of in this climate. So, that's the first problem is systemic.
Yeah.
Now, having said that, you're in the system and you're doing what you can. It's how you show up. If you show up emotionally present and with a light sense of humor, and not taking all that dysfunction personally, and being able to stay present with those kids, then you're doing what you can. Mm-hmm. Then you're doing what you can. If you give them lots of room for self-expression, creative activity, paint, art.
Yeah.
By the way, what are the programs that are first cut when school cuts? They cut music, they cut art. Mm-hmm. Just the very things that human beings need, especially these kids. But if you can incorporate that along with just your presence, emotional presence, then you're doing what you can. If you want to read more about that, I would highly encourage you to read my book on ADD called Scattered, okay? But that's really the essence of it, is who you are when you show up in that classroom. Because those same kids will do much better with the teacher who's emotionally present than with one who's emotionally distant. You have to be able to enjoy them, actually. Okay?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Hello, I actually, thank you so much for being here. I actually have not a question, but a comment, so I'm gonna turn and face everybody. I just wanted to say that I hope what everyone gets from this is that these are tools not only to help give us perspective in our own lives, but to begin to connect with people in different ways and share this information, to have the conversations about why it's necessary to really change this society. And begin to break the isolation that you're talking about that's created by a system that puts profit over need. And I think that what the recent Occupy movement has shown us is that there's a lot of anger and dissatisfaction with the society, and it can drive us, but it's not enough, and we need to begin reaching out to others around us, begin to connect, begin to organize, build organizations that can really fight. And hey, you know, you get a handful of people together and you can do an event like this, so it's really not so hard. But so I just hope that we can use this information not only to shape our own perspectives towards addiction and the individuals around us that are suffering from these problems, but also our perspectives on the world and the role that we see ourselves playing in it. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm a psychotherapist with a background in public health and psychology. And
just the mic needs to be closer.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I'm a psychotherapist and actually a wellness mentor now too, with a background in psychology and public health. And I've read three or four of your books, and I really, really admire your thinking and your analysis. And I just recently went to a conference of the International Society for the Ethical Practice of Psychiatry and Psychology, which featured Robert Whittaker, who wrote on Anatomy of an Epidemic, and I hear a lot of similarities to his thinking with yours. And I'm wondering if you could comment on maybe some of the parallels between the marketing of psych drugs, like you had mentioned earlier, and the addiction, and the effects that both have on diminishing our health and diminishing our ability to be active participants in shaping our world. And also I wanted to just say that your comment about Joe Hill and the previous speaker's comment, don't mourn, organize, I think is very valid and helpful.
Thank you. Well, it's hard to say too little about the role of the drug companies in this culture. Let me tell you a little story about Rudy Giuliani. He of sainted New York mayor fame. Rudy, in Vancouver, I've been involved with a facility that some of you may have heard about. It's called Insight. It's North America's only supervised injection site. People are actually allowed to bring their drugs there and inject under supervision with safe conditions, clean needles, sterile water and all that, and not get arrested. And the federal government that I've already mentioned in passing right now tried to shut it down, was prevented from doing so by a 9-0 vote of our Supreme Court. They have not been in power long enough to pack the Supreme Court with their followers so that this Supreme Court voted them down. Now, Rudy Giuliani, the Insight, the supervised injection site, has been shown in a couple dozen studies to save lives, to prevent disease transmission, and of course, to save huge amounts of money in terms of healthcare costs. Rudy Giuliani came to Vancouver and advised us to shut it down because it promotes addiction. Now, OxyContin is an opiate, a synthetic opiate, that has killed hundreds, maybe thousands of people in the United States. It overdoses. It's wiped out entire villages in Appalachia. It's a highly addictive drug. And I think it was Purdue or Pfizer. I think it was Pfizer. I forget which. If I'm slandering one of them, that's okay. They deserve it anyway. but for other reasons, you know. But they marketed this drug as a non-addictive narcotic. This is after they had internal studies that showed that it was highly addictive. The attorney, what do you call the prosecuting attorney in a town?
District attorney.
Somewhere in the U.S. decided to take the company to court for this. The company hired a consulting company to help protect them from the legal suit, the head of which is Rudy Giuliani. Here's this guy who was defending the mass murder of young people with OxyContin coming to tell us to shut down the supervised injection site that saves lives. But he's working for, now the company ended up paying out $800 million, which they could take out of their left hip pocket because they make billions of dollars of profits every year on the product. They're the most ruthless killers in the face of the earth. They don't care what they sell to who as long as it works. That's in practice. And, you know, it's been exposed over and over and over again by whistleblowers. And the medical profession is completely enthralled to the drug companies because we follow the research, and who funds the research? Them with the money, and who's got the money? Which means that approaches that are not pharmacological are not investigated very much because there's no money in them. There's no money in doing research to show that if you help people stay home with their children, that that's going to make for better brains. But there's money in showing that if you screwed up the kid badly enough, then if you give him medication, that'll control his behavior. So the drug companies feast off the dysfunction of capitalist society, and they further it with their propaganda. And they keep the medical profession very much in their pockets. So that's the role of the drug companies. What can you say?
100,000 a year die from drugs.
Well, yeah, not to mention all the people that die of the prescribed drugs, of course. Of course. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So I want to take another round of hands. Those of you who are standing here, stay here, but additional. So if you can just raise your hands and I'll take five from this side and five from this side. Sure, I mean, if there's not enough hands, then we'll just, each of you.
And let me tell you one more thing, that those of you that are, you know, are in agreement with the perspective I put out to you tonight, if you want to share it with others, at my website, there's several of my lectures and interviews. It doesn't cost you any money to go there, and nobody's going to sell you any products. And videos and lectures on this topic and similar ones are available online. My website is www, and then just my name, drgabormate.com, and you're all welcome to check it out and to share those interviews and lectures with other people who you think might be interested. Okay?
And also, for those of you who came in later after the announcement was made, I just want to let you all know that we rent this space and we need your donations. So there's a donation box at the entrance. We have a suggested donations of $2, so you don't have to make that, but you know, whatever you can donate will be appreciated. So just, you can raise your hands, and you have one, two, and line up here, yeah.
Thanks. I don't necessarily have a question, I don't think. I just really want to say that I appreciate the work that you're doing. And I just discovered you. I mean, not that you weren't already there, but...
Yeah, nice to be discovered.
Right, kind of like Columbus and coming here, right? So a few weeks ago, I saw an acupuncturist at Kaiser that I wasn't particularly fond of, uh-huh. but for some strange reason, he mentioned you. I don't even know why, but uh-huh. I do believe in spiritual things, so I think that's why. Anyway, I started reading the work, and I was like, he's one of my people. I'm no doctor, but this is life work. You know what I mean? This is who I am. This is what we do. This is who we are. Now, the funny thing about this is living in Berkeley, which is like the new South Africa in so many ways, I am just so amazed that there's, you know, not so much diversity here. So I'm really curious about also the impact of living in such a racist place. You know what I mean? The economics of it all, the stressful factors that really, really impact our lives that we don't really like to talk about. We don't really address those things very well.
Yeah.
On any level. Medically, well, educationally, pick a topic. You know? So anyway, just want to say thank you. I greatly appreciate your work, and I'm really happy to introduce you to other people.
Well, thank you.
I already have done that.
Thank you. Well, the racism I alluded to when I mentioned the statistics for death rate for prostate cancer for Afro-American men. That's strictly a product of racism. The stress imposed by racism, that's all it is. It's what's it like to be a black American male in this society. And what's it like to be a Native Indian in this society? In Canada, the 30% of my clients in the downtown east side were First Nations, or Canadian, we call them First Nations people in Canada. They only make up 2 or 3% of the population. If you look at the jail populations in this country or in mine, disproportionately, they're made up of what they call visible minorities, and particularly in Canada, Native Indians. And if you actually look at the history, you get the massive dislocation, oppression, near extermination in some places, and loss of life, land, and livelihood, invalidation of their medicinal practices, invalidation of their spiritual ways, the robbing of their identity, and then the forcible removal of their kids to residential schools, where they were sexually abused for 100 years. As many as 50 to 100,000 people, native kids, died in residential schools, and tens of thousands, we don't even know where they were buried. And the residential schools, the last one in Canada, only closed down in 1998. And then we wonder why they're addicted, why their suicide rate is multiple times, or you know, double, triple the times of the rest of the population, why they engage in so-called criminal activity, why their autoimmune disease rate is so much higher, why there's so much diabetes, why there's more mental health disorders, addiction, and so on. It's the sheer product. It's not that the system only targets those people, but it targets them most egregiously. And the effects show up in the health, the physical and mental health, or the lack of it. And when I go around speaking in Canada, and I ask, how many people have you heard about the residential schools when you went to school? Very few people put their hands up. So then there's this, you think this country has dealt with slavery yet? It hasn't begun to yet deal with slavery yet. Not at all. Not the actual impact of it. Not the ongoing resonance of it. We think it's something in the past. It's not in the past. It's living right now. It's living right now. And I'm going to have to say something here, and I, you're going to have to tell me if I'm out of line here, and I don't mind being out of line sometimes. You know, when Obama was elected, I said to my wife on the day of the inaugural, this is the highest point of his presidency. I didn't expect anything. It's just another shock. There's another face that is more palatable to a lot of people. Because he, you know, by the way, why is he called a black man, by the way? He's half white, isn't he? I don't get that. Intellectually, I don't get it. Because you know, that's a racist thing in itself, isn't it? The one drop that's black is going to make him a black man? You know? Is that, and that's what I'm saying. That itself is a racist assumption. You know? And a lot of people bought into it, of course, because he looked a certain way. But what did he end up being? He ended up being a cover for the same system. You know, so that the very fact that we even celebrate that is a manifestation of the ongoing racism. Yeah. It's a fact in this society, and it's one of those facts that we're not even near having fully come to terms with. And of course, the same thing in my country as well. So, and the health implications are obvious. The infant mortality rate in some areas of this country, particularly in poor black areas, is worse than some third world countries. That's how it is.
Hi, I really appreciate your views, and you validated a lot of things that, conclusions that I've come to kind of independently. I'm a recovering addict. I stopped using alcohol and drugs a long time ago, and one thing that they, almost all the stories had in common, so I know a lot of stories, is that there's so much trauma and so much pain in their background. And now I'm working with youth in Oakland Unified School District, and again, like all their behavior makes sense according to the trauma. So my question has to do with something a little bit more personal. Mm-hmm. Someone in my family, they have a grown child, like 28-year-old child, who's in Napa State, diagnosed with schizophrenia, which, by the way, I don't agree with any of this diagnosis bullshit. But and he's stuck. He's stuck there, and I don't know how. I've suggested other ways to get him. I don't know where to kind of. I feel kind of helpless to guide, but I feel like I really want to help them get him out.
What is Napa State? Is it a prison? Is it an institution of some kind?
It's a mental health institution.
Yeah.
So basically he's a prisoner in there.
Yeah.
And that's how they're treated.
I don't know what to tell you. I can tell you that the best place in the world to be a schizophrenic, you know where that is? In a village in Africa or India. Because people can stay in the community and still be appreciated for their differentness, and not, people aren't scared of you. He could live in a community if the community was there, but there is no community, is there? So I don't know what to say. I truly don't know what to say. I'm sorry. But what you can do on a personal level is to continue to believe in him and to connect with him. That's what you can do, and that'll offer him something. What you can do on a larger level, I truly can't tell you.
Hello. I really enjoyed this book because I felt like it helped me understand on a deeper level addiction. But recently I had a friend that came to me who told me that he had gotten sick. I had taken him to the hospital, and he told me that he came back and they diagnosed him as HIV positive.
Yeah.
And so I started to do a lot of research, and it was very confusing. I started to find all this speculation of people saying that that it was a certain drug that they gave people with HIV that actually caused AIDS, or the HIV didn't exist. I just found a lot of information that was very confusing. And I was like really struggling to process everything. And then 2 weeks later, he actually got another diagnosis saying that he was actually negative. Mm-hmm. And so I was, it just gave me like a deeper understanding of the medical system and how much we're lied to. And the fact that we don't have access to that language even, because I just felt like I was trying, just struggling to try to understand what all these scientists and doctors were saying.
Yeah.
And so just currently, what we're dealing with right now within this system and the capitalist state just lying to us every day, like, do you have any kind of, like, I guess, advice in just even trying to help our family members that are diagnosed and given these medications, well, and we don't have access to, like, that information?
Okay, look, so what I would say to you is, and it may not be easy for you to hear this, but I just want to answer you in a way that I would find helpful. And it's for you to decide what is helpful to you, okay? But here's what I say, with all respect, that there's every reason for people to have lack of trust. There's every reason for people to want to find out for themselves and to be really sure about things, and that's absolutely essential. Because the system, in all the ways and in many more that I haven't talked about, does let people down. But that doesn't mean that everything you're told is false automatically. You have to have some capacity to evaluate information without an automatic dismissal of it just because it comes from the system. So you have to be open to the possibility that they're speaking the truth as they understand it, at least. Now, it's possible with HIV to get a positive test, what's called a false positive, because according to some chemical tests, it turns out to be positive, and then on further testing, it turns out to be negative. It doesn't mean anybody was lying. It just means that one test showed up one way, and when they double-checked, it showed up another way. And I very much suspect that that's what happened in this case. Mm-hmm. A certain percentage of tests for any disease are going to show up so-called false positives, and that's why you do another kind of test to confirm it or to reject the original finding. I'd rather suspect that's what happened in this case. And I don't have to think about conspiracies or lies or anything. It's just what happens in the ordinary course of medical practice. Okay.
Yeah, I guess my question was more like, when we find out information, how do we then?
Well, you do your best. You investigate it and you look into it.
Sorry.
But what I'm saying is, don't automatically reject it.
Okay.
Be open-minded about it. Be vigilant. Investigate it. And then finally, and the more you do it, the more you'll be able to trust your inner guidance about it. So keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing the research, but don't be in an automatic resistance or rejection mode either. Okay? That won't help you.
I kind of have a specific question. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the pharmaceutical industry, but specifically how it relates to psychiatry in the sense of the... that book that they put out every so often, the DSM, the way they define the diseases and they define the treatment and how there's sort of this back and forth influence. I've heard you speak about it before, but I think it's very interesting.
Well, the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, and I think its fifth iteration is coming up very soon. Yeah, it's coming out very soon. And what it does is it categorizes certain behaviors or manifestations, and then it calls them a disease or a syndrome. And as a description, it's probably accurate that certain people function in these ways, like ADHD, people have to be hyperactive, and they tend to not be able to pay attention, or they lose track, and they may have poor impulse control. Well, that's true of a certain number of people. So then you diagnose them with ADHD, for example. The problem is that the DSM thinks, and the psychiatrists think, that now that you've described somebody, you've actually explained them. But you haven't. All you've done is you've described them. And as Daniel Siegel, a UCLA psychiatrist, said very astutely, that the DSM deals in categories, not in pain. The DSM says nothing about the actual painful experiences that cause a person to tune out and be absent-minded. Because tuning out and absent-mindedness are a defense against stress. The DSM says nothing about that. And the current concept of biological psychiatry is limited to the understanding that because the brain functions in certain ways, then we can alter the brain chemistry, alter the brain biology by certain powerful drugs. Therefore, we've treated the person. No, you haven't. And I'm somebody who's taken medication. I prescribe them. I've taken an antidepressant, Prozac. I've taken stimulants for my ADHD. I don't take anything anymore, and I don't think I'll ever have to, because I think I've dealt with this stuff. I think I have. But, you know, I'm not against Prozac. God, when it helped me, it didn't take 6 weeks, it didn't take 2 weeks, it took half an hour. Because my serotonin levels, I'm sure, were low, and the Prozac elevated them rather quickly. The problem is that biological psychiatry never asks, why is that brain low on serotonin? What happened to that child? Does the fact that I was born a Jewish infant in a country that shortly after was occupied by the Nazis, and my mother was a terrified woman, and my father was away, does that have something to do with the fact that I might have low serotonin levels in my brain? Or the fact that I stressed myself by being a workaholic, and I haven't learned to take care of myself in certain ways? So if I could learn to take care of myself better, if I looked at my childhood pain, if I actually got into a different relationship to myself, could that elevate my serotonin levels so I don't need the Prozac? Biological psychiatry doesn't ask those questions. It just looks at the symptoms of depression and says, you got depression, here's the treatment. But there's no intent or there's no effort to understand the relationship of that person's biology to his life experience in the past and in the present. So the DSM as a descriptor is this is what it looks like. And that's fair enough. But they think that when they've made that description, they've understood or explained a human being, and they haven't. Personality disorder. Well, that explains. He's got a personality disorder. The hell he does. He's a human being who suffered so much that he developed certain traits in response to the suffering. That's who he is. And if you want him to get past it, you'll have to treat him differently. You have to treat him like a human being, not just medicate him. And that's what the DSM completely misses.
I'm a little unsure how to phrase this question. I became very determined to get to the bottom of why I was always around so many abusive people at the age of 36. Mm-hmm. So I really started studying domestic violence as well as doing a lot of therapy. I ended up being an activist at the same time because it was a way I could hold a job at night. Yeah. I had to work around my therapist. She was offering me therapy at a decent price during the day. But I ended up seeing a movie called The Corporation, which equates the type of values with being a psychopath. And
I had lunch with the author just a few weeks ago.
Oh.
He lives in Vancouver as well.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And so that's really what the heart of my question is. My father and family and many of the people in my family, I started out as a worker in the mental health field, by the way. They are very accepting of the system as it is. I am very mostly rejecting of it, a capitalist system. Could you speak to this idea that people who are driven to success, for the most part, are being driven to be psychopaths? It's a question.
Well, actually, there have been some interesting studies on the brains of right-wing personalities. It's brain scans. they tend to have a smaller hippocampus. The hippocampus is the place, one of the places of emotion, of memory and emotional memory. In other words, these are very stressed people because the stress hormone cortisol shrinks the hippocampus. The rich have also been shown in a recent brain study to be shorter on empathy with people. They have less capacity to understand the experience of other people. Now, of course, at the extreme end of the scale, the person with no emotional empathy and emotional connection to themselves, you call them a psychopath. And so that we're talking about people, and look at how they behave. Look how they behave. I mean, they behave like they're brain damaged, like they're lacking in certain human capacities. Well, something about the experience makes them that way. And so that there's a good case to be made is that you know, the capitalism mentality is a case of psychopathology. You know, this whole idea that everybody's against you and I have to fight them, what do you call that? You call them paranoia. The idea that I can do anything to anybody and it doesn't matter, what do you call that? You call that sociopathy. I don't want to make politics equivalent with pathology. But certainly the one reflects the other. Yeah.
Gabor, I have read your books and in part studied them. I've shared excerpts with friends and colleagues, sent links to your Democracy Now! Interviews, and have been very moved by them. I don't have a question. I'm not looking for advice, but perhaps you may have some insight for me. I'm a high school teacher in Richmond. Richmond's just north of here. It competes with Oakland for the number of homicides per year. Mm-hmm. I work at a continuation high school. That's a school where the students are either, they're in danger of lots of things. Not graduating is the official thing. Behind in their credits, may be a pregnancy, lots of them have been tangled up with the law, etc. And I found your books wonderfully insightful for my students and elsewhere in my life. And I started the year with the best of intentions to connect with my students, and when you have a classroom of students who many, most, all have signs and symptoms of ADD, ADHD, yeah. And you can't speak one sentence without the ping pong ball of interruptions happening.
Yeah.
I don't know what to do, and I'm searching. I'm not expecting that you have an answer, but perhaps you have an insight.
How are you feeling right now?
Right this second?
Yeah.
Well, kind of nervous. Yeah. Speaking in public.
How do you feel in the classroom?
Frustrated.
That's what they're picking up on.
Yeah.
That's what they're picking up on. Mm-hmm. You can't help from that position. You need to work on yourself. Mm-hmm. You need to be okay with that.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Yeah. you need to be okay and very confident in the face of their dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And you need to enjoy them and welcome them and appreciate them. You need to pick up on their energies and be able to kind of fly with it. If you can't do that, you're going to frustrate and stress yourself. And if you can do it, you'll be able to connect with them in such a way that they'll want to connect with you.
Thank you.
Okay?
Hi.
No, that's not easy, by the way. That's not easy. Yeah, sorry.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you for all that you've shared. My question relates a little bit to what was discussed just a couple of questions ago. Mm-hmm. Given that money and power addictions are rewarded rather than stigmatized,
right,
and that the damage that money and power addicts do is global, we can all see that. Is there something that could facilitate the transformation of the heart and mind of the power-wielding hyper-acquisitive sociopath?
Well, Yeah. But you're not likely to be in a position to give it to them. They need to be loved for who they are, not for what they do. But you know, they're not gonna let you close enough to them, because they're too threatened by you. So, is it possible for people like that to transform? Yes, it is. Every once in a while, you know, it's like that slave ship captain who ends up writing Amazing Grace, because he sees the light, and he becomes an anti-slavery advocate. Every once in a while, you get one of these miraculous transformations of somebody who gets really touched with their heart. But that's almost grace, and I don't know how to get close. I mean, see, the problem is that, and by the way, the person who asked about psychopathy and corporations, just look at your presidents. I mean, it's an endless succession of highly dysfunctional people. And Obama looks very sane compared to if he actually had an emotional life, which I doubt that he does. At least he doesn't seem to show any. He's very much like an Iceman. But when I looked at George Bush, when I was in Toronto, it's interesting because when my book on attention deficit came out, that was my first book, the Americans that night when I was in Toronto for the book tour, they were just about to start bombing Serbia. And then in my next book, When the Body Says No on the Stress and Health Connection came out, George Bush starts bombing Iraq. So every time I come up with a book, they start bombing somebody. Which statistically, no more book. But statistically, of course, that's not too difficult because they're always bombing somebody, you know. So, but the point is, when I looked at George Bush on television, and I actually turned off the sound at one point, I didn't see an adult. I saw a scared little kid. If you look at his furrowed brows and his, you know, desperate bravado, and his determination to be a man. There was a scared little kid there. But how do you get close to these people? And if they don't recognize the need to heal, and why would they recognize it when they're adulated for what they do? They can't be helped. So I don't think the solution is going to come from hoping for them to transform. I just don't think that's where it's going to come from. It's possible in certain individual cases, but the people you really have... And interestingly enough, you know what happens to some of these guys? Like McNamara, who was a mass murderer, and then later on repents to some significant degree, you know? And they always repent after they're no longer in power. You know, like, so recently there was a declaration by a whole bunch of international leaders, including... who are the Americans there? One of them was the former head of the Federal Reserve, and of course President Carter, former President Carter, who's one of the one decent guys in a whole lot, as far as I can see. Of course, people can't forgive him for that. And he actually speaks the truth about Palestine, for example. Heaven forbid. But the ones who do get transformed and put out a different point of view, they always do it after they're no longer in power. In other words, when they're no longer getting the accolades for the evil that they do. So it's a great question you have, but I have no answer for it. Although I've just spoke for 3 minutes, but I have no answer to your question. Okay.
I just want to, before
you,
just want to let everybody know that the last person in line will be the last question for now, because we have to be out of here by 7:15.
Perfect. Hi, first of all, thank you for coming out and speaking. You validated a lot of points about my own childhood, which was nice. Secondly, I wanted to maybe digress a little bit. You know, we've talked a lot about core issues and how people often self-medicate, and that's how addictions develop. Yeah. Well, what about treatment options? I mean, like, what are your viewpoints on things like 12-step programs versus medication versus religion versus, you know, I mean, what have you found that something statistically works better?
Well, there's no verses. Yeah. There's no verses. It's whatever works. So the 12-step programs are highly effective for a lot of people. Mind you, there's certain things they miss as far as I'm concerned. Like they rarely get to the childhood core issues. They focus more on the drug use and the cessation of it and the harm them, you know. Nevertheless, because there's group, because there's acceptance, because there's validation, because there's support, they can be very effective. Some people, if they need to be medicated, if some people are very badly depressed and they before they deal with the issues, they just need to feel better. I'm not against antidepressants as long as you're not causing side effects and all that. Spirituality, you know, at the heart of every addiction is the spiritual void. So whether that's addressed through religious practice or some other spiritual practice. Recently, in Canada, I've been working with a Peruvian shamanic plant called ayahuasca. And we've shown great results, which of course caused the government to tell me that the next time I use it, I'll be jailed. This is the subject of a national documentary last week on Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. And 2 days earlier, I got a receipt from the government, a letter from the government saying, if you continue to persist with using this. Now, it's got no toxic effects, no addictive potential, and has shown benefit in all the studies, and therefore it's illegal. I don't know if therefore it's illegal, but it's, you know, so shamanic practices, you know, whatever works. For some people, it's harm reduction. You simply begin by reducing the harm, by giving them clean needles and treating them like human beings. And you don't expect them to give up their drugs. You just support them where they are at. So there's no one treatment that works. And whatever works, and you have to individualize it, and you have to be completely open-minded about it.
Okay? Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hi, Dr. Mate. Everybody, thanks for being here. Your writing is very eloquent, and your speeches too. And I really want to thank you for such careful and thoughtful answering to people's questions. Mm. One thing I just want to, if you would ponder with me and with all of us for a moment, is use of language. Mm-hmm. I mean, the effect of that on the brain. With the Wall Street Occupy movement that's happening now, you hear a lot of, we got to fight, 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 and you have people on this side and that side. And there's no love, there's no community possibilities in that language. And tonight, several times I've heard in the same sentence, I think, or within a couple sentences, people talked about community and building movements, but there was a fight in there. And I could feel my cortisol, probably your adrenaline levels, just going up when I hear that.
Yeah.
So if you could speak to that.
Yeah, sure. Todd and I were talking about that before the event. In my student radical days in the 1960s, I used to be enraged when people said that, you know, these guys are just working out their childhood issues through their politics. But you know what the truth was? It was true. Now, of course, it was an invalid argument. It was true but invalid. The reason it was invalid, because it was used to invalidate the political message. Because as a 21-year-old, I was manifesting my childhood unresolved issues through my politics, didn't make the Vietnam War right. And it didn't diminish the criminality of the slaughter one little bit. But to the extent that I was coming from rage and a sort of a programmed anti-authoritarian sentiment, anti-authority sentiment, that didn't further the effectiveness of the work. So that in political work, and Todd and I were talking about this, it's very important to check in not just with the content of what you're saying, but the emotional resonance of where you're coming from. And insofar as you're coming from rage, that's not metabolized, what you think you're angry about is not actually what you're angry about. And that's why the really evolved political leaders come not from anger, but they come from a place of love. You know, now, that doesn't mean that you're not militant, it doesn't mean that you're not determined, courageous, but it does mean that you don't project more hatred and more rage into this world. Because when that's what you project into the world, that's exactly what you're going to find coming back from you, at you, even from people who otherwise might be able to hear you. But they can't hear you because you're not hearing yourself. So it's very, very important to check in with where you're coming from emotionally. And if you're coming from that place of tightness, and all you just check in, how tight are you feeling? If you're feeling for tightness, put the attention on yourself. And before you speak, deal with that. And then you do speak, you'll create much more listening to what you have to say. Okay? Thank you.
Gabor, thank you very much for being here and taking time from home and family. My name is Ken, and I'm a family doctor and addiction medicine doctor working in an under-resourced public system in the county. Yeah. So everything that you've written about and talk about resonates strongly with me, and I'm particularly interested in the issue of shame, and you have a prescription for dealing with shame,
yeah,
in Scattered in the Realm of Hungry Ghosts. And what you said before really is, I agree with, there's a tremendous amount of shame in this society, the societal shame, especially right. as it relates to racism.
Right.
How could you give us a prescription, your thoughts about the prescription for the societal shame, and maybe summarize your prescription for shame for those who don't haven't read your book?
Well, what do you mean by societal shame now?
I think that we don't want to deal with racism in our society because I believe that there is a shame of what happened in slavery.
Okay.
So how do you connect the dots if that's something that you agree with?
Okay. You know, I don't see it quite the same way. I mean, it might be true, but I think that when we don't want to deal with something, see, when we don't want to deal with racism, what we really don't want to look at is other people's pain. And why don't we even look at other people's pain? Because they haven't dealt with their own. To open myself up to your pain would be to recognize my own. Because I'd have to be caring about you, and that's vulnerable. So the denial of, the racist denial of history that occurs in this country is actually a denial of people's own pain. Now, if you want to know people that deny pain, look at the Tea Party movement. Those people are deeply in pain. They're really troubled, troubled people. Look at poor Michelle Bachmann and her migraine headaches. You know, here's a tortured woman, but she's in absolute denial of it. Just as George Bush was in denial of his own stuff. You know, and so that when you're in denial of your own pain, you can deny the pain of others. So I think it's not just past-based, it's also present-based in people's emotional dynamics in the present. And of course, that means that if they open themselves up to their own pain, they'd have to look at the real nature of their society. And that would bring them into conflict with their society. So people have all kinds of reasons not to look at the shame of it all, both for personal and for broader social reasons. I think the only way to address it on a social level is not to add to it, which is to say, not to be hostile in how you express yourself, not to be demeaning of the opposition, but to actually see the humanity. Not to agree with, not to support, but not to demean either. So don't add to the shame in the society. You can't deal with the shame in the society if you shame your political opponents. You can point out the contradictions in their position. You can point out the impact of their policies. But you don't have to do it in a way that adds to the burden of shame in the world. So that's very hard to avoid because we're also triggered by these people. I mean, my natural impulse is to want to scream at them. But that's my own problem, not theirs. How I would deal with shame on an individual level, that's a different story, and probably time prevents me from going into it. But fundamentally, shame actually has to do with disconnection. So shame has nothing to do with what you do or what you don't do. Shame has to do with how connected or disconnected you are. You can shame a 9-month-old infant. You can make him go like this. Go into the shame state simply by when he's looking into mother's eyes, the mother looks away, the child will feel shamed. And shame is a physiological state caused by disconnection from the parent. So the way you deal with shame on the individual level is to connect, which is really what I'm saying on the political level as well. Okay?
Thank you. Hi. Thank you for that talk. It was fascinating. I'm really concerned about the way we treat prisoners in this society, and you went over a bunch of stressors, you know, discussing breast lumps, and a lot of them seem to be exactly the way we treat prisoners, you know, isolation, lack of expression, lack of control.
Right.
I'm just wondering if there's studies that kind of go over the public health consequence of a prison system that treats individuals like that, or what you might see as the consequence. I mean, it, according to your other point, it would seem to be like a really large consequence to the prisoners' health. So.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are studies. I'm not familiar with them, but I mean it's self-evident. If you take monkeys and you isolate them, you're actually diminishing the number of dopamine receptors. Dopamine is the essential incentive and motivation chemical. When you put them back into society, their dopamine receptor levels increase. When you put a person into isolation, you're decreasing their dopamine levels. You're increasing their irritability, their depression, their despair, their sense of isolation. And you're interfering with their brain functioning. And there are many, many people in isolation in this country. More people than anywhere else in the world, I think. By the way, you probably know the statistic, but Americans make up 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's jail population. Every fourth person in prison in the world is a citizen of the land of the free. And many of those people are treated horribly. Well, I don't have to tell you what the implications are. So they're horrid. And we just seem to accept them as natural. We seem to think that somehow this is okay. Well, I could give you a long talk about it, but I mean, it should be evident from everything I've said, and certainly in your understanding, that when you treat people like that, that's why I said that the justice system is criminal. Because it actually, what's criminality? It's the commission of acts that hurt other people. Well, this system is designed to hurt and to hurt and to hurt, and to increase the pain, and to increase the suffering, and to make people more despairful. Now, there was a film, some of you may have seen, called The Dahmer Brothers. Anybody see that film?
Yeah,
The Dahmer Brothers. It's in Georgia, is it, or Alabama, some high security prison in the deep south. And these Buddhist meditation teachers go in there, and they have a retreat with these lifers who've all committed really violent crimes. And for 10 days, these prisoners don't speak, but it's a silent vipassana meditation type approach. They had received some instruction, but they don't talk. This is right inside the high security prison. At the end of it, they're transformed. Simply through the act of being led through, the fact of being led through a 10-day compassionately grounded meditational approach. And they open up, and their own responsibility for what they've done. They become more cooperative. They become more grounded in themselves. And they're not doing this to get parole, because they're not going to get parole. It's simply a transformation that's actually possible in the prison itself, given the right conditions. Needless to say, the program was stopped because the neighborhood Christians said, this is witchcraft, Well, apparently it's been reinstituted again. But what I'm saying is that even if you decide that you have to incarcerate people to protect society, you don't have to treat them like non-humans. And when you treat them like humans, they can actually transform. Because needless to say, all those people, although the film didn't go into it, but all those people have been traumatized individuals. That's why they ended up committing the crimes that they did. And it was possible just in that 10 days for them to experience a personal transformation. So that, let me just finish with this thought. The human possibility is enormous. The potential is infinite. And let me read you with a quote from the Catholic monk Thomas Merton. As a good Jewish Marxist, I carry this Catholic's book in my pocket. And he says, in order to gain possession of ourselves, we have to have some confidence, some hope of victory. And in order to keep that hope alive, we must usually have some taste of victory. We must know what victory is and like it better than defeat. The victory for the troubled ones, for the mentally ill ones, for the addicted ones, for the prisoner ones, for the dysfunctional children ones, for the despairful ones. What is victory? Genuine connection with other human beings. And when you offer people that in any setting, the human potential for transformation is infinite. Well, thank you. Thank you.